Hello, everyone, and welcome to Inside the Studio on iHeartRadio. My name's Jordan Runtog, but enough about me. My guest today is one of my favorite contemporary songwriters. In February, she released her new album, Little Oblivions, a stunning work of emotional bravery, inspired in large part by a crisis of faith. The songs chronicle her difficult last few years, as she relapsed into substance abuse and began to reconsider her devout Christian beliefs. Both her sobriety and her religion formed crucial pillars of her personal and public identity, serving as themes for past songs and frequent topics of interviews. Now her relationship to both was radically shifting, leading to a period of self-reflection and reevaluation. She canceled a tour in 2019 and returned to her home in Nashville, where she reset. She finished out her undergraduate degree at Middle Tennessee State, and for a time briefly wondered whether she'd ever return to her former life as a musician. Thankfully, she did, and the result is her most compelling work to date. Musically, she expands on her acoustic past with a full band sound, playing nearly all of the instruments herself. The lyrics tackle the pain of spiritual uncertainty, with phrases that are self-aware and at times self-lacerating, an exorcism of private shame. "I wish you'd hurt me," she sings on Song in E. "It's the mercy I can't take." In addition to her music, she's one of the all-time great interviewees. In conversation, she's insightful, warm, self-deprecating, and eminently fearless. These are the same traits that make her music so darn good. I'm so happy to welcome Julian Baker.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time today. I'm so thrilled to speak to you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me and taking the time to speak with me. It's mutual.
So many things I want to ask you, but I want to start with a question that's been imbued with a whole new level of meaning in the last year, and that's, how are you? How are you doing today?
You know, today, I'm really good. Got my coffee. It was raining this morning, but the sun is coming out. Yeah, I'm just trying to be happy about the little things. I don't know if there's one thing that this last year has taught me, it's like how to focus in on and recognize the things that actually do make me happy and what I can celebrate, because it seems like there's been a deficit of things to celebrate or be happy about for a long time.
Elements of clarity, I say, in not really having a lot of external distractions, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, for so much of the last year, for all of us, it's been about accepting uncertainty into our lives and kind of allowing it to exist without completely crippling us, which in a way is a major through line through your new record, Little Oblivions, about accepting that uncertainty and sort of being okay with it. What's that process been like for you?
Oh, man, it's been difficult. I mean, I think it's taken a lot of work in my own personal life to accept that it's healthier to just sit with uncertainty or discomfort than to try to medicate or negate or assuage it with whatever behavior, you know, it could be anything, substances or like compulsive behaviors or just downright like suppression. And I feel a lot more peaceful, actually. And I think I was really apprehensive about this record for the reasons you mentioned, because it does completely concerns in totality of the record is about trying to dismantle belief systems and value systems in your life and rebuild them from scratch. And I was really apprehensive about doing press around this record, but I found the more that I talk about it, the more clarity I actually have about what needed to be done in my own life. Yeah, sorry, my dog is crawling around under my desk, so if you hear the little, like, this noise, it's just her tail.
No, not at all. You and I share something. For my entire life, I've been completely apathetic to animals. And in the last year, a switch went off in me and I'm desperate for a dog. My apartment will let me have one. I become one of those people that actually like sees them on the street and elbows my girlfriend like, "Oh my God, look at that." So no, that is adorable.
It's crazy. I got a dog a little bit before quarantine and I don't know what I would have done without having a dog, but also like, yeah, I was kind of the same way. I wasn't ambivalent about animals, but I was just like, cool.
They're cute. Moving on. Yeah.
They're cute. Moving on. Yeah. Now it's like, I cannot stop myself from acknowledging every dog I see. If I see a dog and we're driving, I will interrupt any conversation to be like, check out that dog. It's the same thing with my partners. Like, oh my God. Yeah. We've seen like 5 dogs. You don't have to point them all out to me, but yeah, I get you.
Well, I'm glad we have that connection. I feel less alone now.
Yeah.
It's been such a transformative few years for you, and your relationship to a lot of, like, as you mentioned, crucial emotional and spiritual pillars have changed. Has your relationship to music changed at all?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, maybe not necessarily that it's changed, but that, I don't know, it feels more like a returning. Like, it felt like there was something that I needed to uncover that had become convoluted about music for me because of being plunged into the world of being a performer with, you know, albeit a regular size, small one. Like, I have this platform and this, like, public awareness, and, like, people are aware of my music and follow it, and while in the scheme of things, that recognition is only minuscule, it felt so huge to me, and it happened very quickly. And music became something that I did with the desire to, like, positively impact the world, and with an extreme amount of consideration for the impact that what I said or in my songs, you know, would have on a listener. Also, I think, you know, just because playing music became, for the first time in my life, my livelihood, I don't know, there's also a lot of, like, fear tied up in that, and a risk aversion that comes with feeling that this is not only my creative outlet where I get to experiment and explore and inquire into my own being, it's now what I do so that I can have a roof over my head and so that I can pay other people in my life so that they can live. And that's really, like, that's a big shift to undergo. And then I think I just kind of glossed over it because touring, the inertia of touring is so constant that you're, like, being propelled into a new city and a new situation and a new performance space literally every day. So yeah, when I took some time off of the road, I think it was like, I always say this, but it was like riding a bicycle slowly, and everything just got kind of, like, off balance and wobbly, and I had to stop doing what I was doing so I could analyze, like, why am I making music in the first place? And I think after having some time away from existing purely as a performer and doing music for an audience, I had the gift of perspective where I recognized that I was still writing songs even though I thought, like, maybe no one will hear them. I don't know if I'll make another record again. I don't know if I'll ever be able to tour again, but I'm still making songs because it's something integral to how I process my emotions and how I understand the world around me and myself. And I think I don't want to say a renewed love for music. Like, I don't want to say that I've developed a renewed love for music as if I was ever jaded or disillusioned with it in the first place, because I've never wavered on the things I've wavered on about music aren't whether or not I love playing it, whether or not I'm going to pick up an instrument again. It's been like, do I think that I am capable of making music in the context of being a performer is my job. Yeah, so now I think I'm trying to do a better job of separating those things so that I can have a healthier relationship with music itself.
And it must have been so great to step back and then choose to get back into music and to actually know, like, no, this is the thing. This is actually something that I want to be involved with. And to know that you made that choice must feel really, I don't know if empowering is the right word, but must really renew your faith in the music.
Yeah, empowering is totally the right word. I don't know. And I think it had a lot to do also with the fact that, like, I collapsed myself with the identity of being a performer, and then that was the sole focus of my life, is, like, not performing as in, like, playing a part, but performing as in hitting the right notes
and wrapping your whole, like, self-worth up in that too.
Yeah, exactly. And then when I realized that, if, you know, it was this kind of, it was a really painful experience for, like, you know, me to go to a really unhealthy place and watch everything that I had thought, you know, that I built up around my life that I guessed felt like being a successful musician, you know, watching all that kind of, like, go away and going back to school and thinking about maybe doing something else for a living for a while, like, that was helpful for me to understand, like, I can make music without putting so much pressure on myself as this entity in public space that also has to perform. I can just make music because I believe that the things that human beings create seeking understanding are the artworks they make are ultimately just a piece of communication, and that's fine. You can't put that on a hierarchical scale of like good music and bad music. But I mean, you know, I believe that. I'm not sure if like hundreds of music publications believe that, but you know.
I should have said this earlier. The album is absolutely incredible. In addition to so many other adjectives, it's just such a fearless record. The vulnerability and the honesty is just so admirable and just really inspiring. I mean, I hope that that's something that you feel.
Yeah, no, I mean, releasing this record, I was, you know, I already said I was pretty apprehensive about it, but in some ways it's been quite liberating to put something out that felt, I don't know, it felt like a departure from my old music for me, but then in the grand scheme of things, it's like, no, it really just, it still sounds like my songwriting. It's just like now there's drums. But it did feel very, I think maybe what was more meaningful to me was the lyrical content being so explicit in a way where it was like, I don't know, trying to dismantle publicly the ideas that maybe people who listen to my music had about me, and trying to unsaddle myself with the identity of being a person who practices sobriety perfectly, a person who practices kindness perfectly, a person who's like in any way like well put together. And it's like to expose those things felt almost relieving to me. You know.
There was a great quote you gave, and I hate reading quotes back because that always sounds like something a prosecutor does. But there's an amazing quote that really stuck with me. It said, this record is about letting go of the prospect of ever being a fully good person. And I a part of me smiled at that because I thought, cool, join the club. Like, that's an incredibly high bar to set for oneself. And to kind of let yourself off the hook has got to be liberating as a human and certainly as an artist.
Yeah, and I think it also, like, it enables me to focus more, like when you say like letting yourself off the hook, it is kind of like that. And I think it's kind of a double-edged sword of a revelation, because I think there was a period in my life, especially like throughout the writing of this record, when I was really in the trenches of like figuring out sobriety again, figuring out faith again. Like there was this point, I think, where I felt the most nihilistic manifestation of that. Like I was letting go of the fact that I was constantly concerned with like how the things I were doing were not enough, or they were not good enough, or I could be a better person, and constantly evaluating all of my actions in this way that was really like defeatist, because there was always going to be some way that I had fallen short of my values. And then when I realized like, well, I'm just a human and nobody's perfect, I think I went through this phase of just like, well, then why don't I just do whatever I want? Because I'm like, you know, and I feel like that's common to people when they have an existential crisis or a crisis of faith. It's just like, well, if the rules are made up and subjective, then
how about I just feel good?
How about I just feel, well, yeah, and then you find out that so many of the things, I'm trying to explain this articulately, so forgive me, but
you're more articulate than I will ever be, by the way, so I just, please.
I'm trying really hard. So like now, it's not so much as me letting myself off the hook, it's just like practicing compassion for myself that allows me in many ways to be more compassionate to other people too. But I think what I had to learn with all of the things that I was convicted about is that, like, I think I had an ideological belief that, I don't know, being sober, being straight edged, or being a vegan, or praying every morning was like this thing that I did to like purify and perfect myself. And now it's more like, I don't want to spend my life with a crippling addiction because it actually doesn't feel good. Like, sure, it feels good sometimes, and then most of the time it just makes you sick and full of regret and unable to do the things you want to do in your life. And so it's like, instead of coming to these decisions about the way I live my life from a point of like, well, it's the good thing to do, it's the better thing to do to be sober, it's like, I now know that it makes me feel better. It improves my quality of life, and I can like make decisions about how to better be in the world that pertain to like my happiness, which is something that I just didn't, you know, like I just didn't include how a decision affects my own happiness or health very much into my evaluation of what was morally right and wrong, because a lot of my conceptualization about doing the right thing involved self-denial and sacrifice. And yeah, reframing it that way was really helpful for me.
Sounds like in a lot of ways it was like your decision to go back to music. I am choosing this. This is what I was doing before, but now it's because I want to and not because I think I'm supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. Totally.
One of my favorite tracks on the album, and I'm probably going to say this about six different songs because it's so hard to choose because it's such an amazing album, Relative Fiction, which to my ears sounded a lot like that battle between the sort of, I guess for lack of a better term, public life and private life. It sounds like that was a really, a beautiful way to illustrate what you were just mentioning.
Oh, totally. That song, there's actually a ripoff or like a slightly modified John Steinbeck quote. I remember I was talking to one of my friends about how I was just feeling kind of directionless because for so long my life had been governed by a very specific set of principles. And when I started to question and really interrogate and change those principles, it made me feel kind of like pessimistic about ever knowing what the right thing is to do or being like a fully healed person. And yeah, my friend was just like, there's this John Steinbeck quote. It's like, now that you're not perfect, you can just be good. And man, I don't know. It gives me like a visceral emotional reaction to hear those words. And like, that's, if you had to sum up like Relative Fiction in a sentence, that's the song. I mean, that quote literally like is why I wrote that song, like thinking about that principle.
That's an incredible line.
Yeah, it's just, you know, trying to permit yourself to be imperfect so that you can get outside of the cycle of self-hatred, which actually makes it harder to be a healthy, kind person, you know.
Perfection's a moving target anyway.
Yeah, sure, exactly.
It's funny how forgiveness is such a crucial tenet of, you know, of Christianity faith, but self-forgiveness is the hardest thing in the world.
Yeah, and I wonder if people, like, the reason why I think forgiveness is so hard as a person who has unfortunately made a lot of hurtful mistakes and thinks a lot about the concept of forgiveness and if I will ever really feel a certainty of being forgiven by, like, my friends or whatever, or by the world. I think what's so uncomfortable sometimes with people about forgiveness is that they mistake forgiveness for absolution, right? Like, so I think, and you know, this could change because emotions are emotions and feelings are feelings, but like, if right now I feel like I'm at a place where I can look at this catalog of all the mistakes that I have made and the, I don't want to say the wrong things, but like the destructive things that I have done, and I can look at them without excusing myself for them, but still
showing compassion to yourself.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I still have to hold myself accountable, just like, you know, if I forgive somebody else for something that they do, I still hold them accountable for their actions. And I think sometimes like accountability and forgiveness get a little muddied in people's brains and their, yeah.
The work you do, I mean, it touches so many people, myself included. I wanted to ask you about your writing process. I mean, is it like a daily practice for you? Like some people run, some people do yoga or meditation, or is it something that you go to when you feel inspired and you sit down and go to work?
I've been trying to think of how to describe it, but like, it seems like, especially lyric writing is an ongoing practice. Like just in my life, I find myself trying to let myself be sensitive to and aware of the poetic or symbolic or meaningful things that happen just in life or in conversation. And so it's like a lot of my writing process is just gleaning images from my life, just from what's happening around me and the conversations I'm having, gathering material and then trying to assemble them into a narrative, playing my instrument and trying to do not just practicing old songs, but like improvisational, just kind of fiddling is a daily practice for me. Just because, I don't know, I know that I have an obsessive part of my personality. And so I try to pick up my instrument and do like commit myself to either writing a song or practicing skills or learning something I didn't know about a guitar pedal I have every day because, you know, I want to keep learning and bettering myself. But songs come together in a much less structured way, you know. I know there's some songwriters that are like, yeah, I write a song every day just as practice, and I could never. It would be a dumb, bad song that I would have to cannibalize and Frankenstein back together as some other song.
I read that that you wrote a thesis on synesthesia, which is something that I believe that you is something that's a part of your writing process. Can you talk a little more about that? I'm not sure if I'm describing it right, but basically assigning, I'm going to get this completely wrong, but assigning colors to sounds and vice versa.
Yeah, what's really...
That's so cool.
This is the most on-brand thing for me to say is that I told one person in an interview that, and then I started having this internal crisis of like, do I really experience synesthesia? Do I experience this phenomenon? Because in my thesis, one of the things, this is so like me to be like, is this actually true? Like, is what I'm saying true? Can I verify it? It's a mental event. So like, no, I can't. But I don't want to sound like I'm just like making up stuff. But basically in a part of the thesis that I did, it was about synesthesia, but it was also about how people, there have been like linguists, like linguistic analysts who like try to create a parallel, like a formulaic parallel between the arrangement of music and like language and grammar. And while I do believe that music is a communication method, I think what's special about it is that in its purest form, it, and especially how I experience it, it can transcend language. Like, so of course, like I'm talking about non-lyrical music specifically. I'm talking about like sounds, not about the poetry that I lay on top of the sounds that I create. But there was this entire portion of my thesis where I was studying like the research methods of synesthesia, because just like anything, it's happening inside the mind. So like anything psychological, it's happening inside the mind. So there's like virtually no way to recreate or explain another person's experience except for them telling you. And so there's all these fields like to like verify that a person is having a synesthetic experience versus, because I feel like I could just play like, I don't know, a sad piano song for somebody on the street, and I would be like, what color is this song? And they would probably be like, blue, because blue is a color we associate with sadness and mournfulness. Or maybe I play them a disco track and they're like, yellow, because yellow is a color we associate with happiness. But yeah, I'm decently confident that that is not what's happening with me, that it's not just like a collection of like cultural associations between color and sound. It's like, man, I don't know. I was listening to it. What song was I listening to the other day? I was like, the song's orange. I don't know how to tell you why. The song's just orange. I don't know how to explain it. Yeah, it's just like music, especially instrumental music, puts me in a very like meditative place, and I experience it in my body in a very vivid way. So yeah, I don't know. I just feel like there's almost this tactile, there's like texture to sound. And especially during quarantine, and you know, we were just talking about the shift in my relationship to music. It's like I have been, you know, past when I thought I was going to return to touring after taking some time off. It's now been an additional year of being at home and not really being in a performance space and playing my instrument every day, practicing piano, or even like trying to teach myself more production stuff and like how to use compression and distortion and EQ things. Like that's all a very visual experience to me. Like I don't know how to describe it. It's so difficult.
It makes total sense to me. Sound waves and light is waves too. It just all, it seems like it's all about just perceiving and letting it come to you, I guess.
I don't know. I read this book called Born on a Blue Day about this guy who memorized, he like at one time held the world record for memorizing the most numbers of pi. There was this passage, I remember reading it when I was like 11. I don't know, I just used to pick up whatever book in Barnes & Noble and be like, sure, I'll read this. So I picked up this memoir knowing nothing about it, and I was like 11 or 12. And there's this part where he's describing how he's reciting the numbers of pi, and then it all kind of like blends into a landscape. I don't know, imagine like a video game moving, or like a note reel as you're moving through.
Yeah.
But then it's like, what's happening? I was going to be like, imagine if Windows Visualizer was just happening in your head all the time. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I forgot about that. Wow. Yeah.
Do that for like hours. Like I would just download stuff off iTunes and then sit there with Windows Visualizer open.
I used to do that all the time. I used to put like pet sounds on or something and just like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's interesting for me is, like, I would always feel, like, this level of disconnect with, because I didn't have any agency over the images, but I've, like, it happens especially when I play piano, where if I just, like, find myself in a key or in a mode that I'm super comfortable in, and I get into the, like, flow state of intuitive playing past the really, like, calculated aware part, it's like, yeah, I don't know, it's like watching a landscape go by from a train, when just like watching sound change. It's really beautiful. I wish I could explain it better, but yeah, I probably sound like a crazy person. I'm not like literally hallucinating.
No, you explained
when I play
it perfectly.
It's in my mind's eye. I'm not just like, yeah, at the end of this I'm just like, and there's acid involved. That was a joke.
Yeah, ayahuasca helps, yeah.
Yeah, the ayahuasca really helps me get in the synesthesia zone. No, I'm terrified to ever... My brand of substance abuse is always the numbing and the dampening things that kind of, like, restrict feeling and emotion. I'm terrified of...
I could never let go.
Dude, I know. It's so crazy. I'm like, it's already dark enough in there as it is. I don't want to, like, explore... like, I don't want to expand the darkness. I just, like, nah, I'm good. I'm good with where I'm at right now. It's all I can do.
God, that's so... that's why I love Song in E, because to me, that sentiment really resonated with me, because it was like wishing that anxiety or pain could be on something on the outside, because I feel like I'm happiest when there's a problem that I can point to and solve, because as soon as that's out, it's like, oh, man, it's just me. Oh, man.
Oh, it turns out that it's really just my brain. Yeah, like, it's difficult. And, you know, that song is like, it's about being in a relationship that is difficult and how it's almost more painful to deal with hurt or try to find a place for it when the two parties or however many parties are involved in your family or your love affair or your whatever. It's almost more painful when you understand that those two parties aren't deliberately hurting each other. Like, it's almost more painful because then there's nowhere to put anger. You know what I mean? Like,
and you feel guilty about it too. Then you're angry and guilty.
You feel guilty about resenting a person that is not hurting you on purpose. And then there's also like this moral hierarchy of like who is giving and receiving forgiveness that can get really uncomfortable. And yeah, that song is me just being like, in the pettiest way to explain it, it's like, when you are angry at somebody and then they're nice to you and you're like, would you just have the decency to be mean to me so we can both just be shitty? Like, why don't you? I want a reason to be shitty to you.
Yeah.
And you're not giving me one. But I mean, I get that's the funny way to describe it. But then it's also like, I don't know. It's challenging to see the limits to your own kindness and like... In another sense, too, it's like I wrote that song at a time where I was like, I just wish that everybody would go ahead and accept that I'm not good so that I can stop having this expectation hovering around me for me to be better. You know what I mean? There is a responsibility that comes with patience and forgiveness. And when your friends don't alienate you and they won't and they continue giving you mercy and graciousness, that then it's like, there's the obligation to show up for that relationship still. And when you feel like getting better or being emotionally available or even just mentally stable is not something possible for you in the near future, like I did, it's sad for your friends to keep forgiving you because it's like, you know.
You do the same for them, I'm sure.
Oh, no, totally. But it's like, it's so much different, I think. And there's a lot of like shame wound up in that, you know? There's a lot of shame in the feeling of wanting to get better, knowing almost certainly you're going to fail a bunch of more times before you're better, and wishing that instead of sticking around and being a witness to self-destruction and pain and causing themselves pain, that your friends would just go away. Like, I don't know. That sounds very like... I was imagining myself as like Quasimodo, like hiding in a cave, but like that's how it gets. That's how it gets when you feel like you're so deep down into something that you, even you can't control it and you don't see a way out. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just going to go chain myself to a wall because I'm going to do something destructive and I wish you wouldn't come keep trying to hang out with me because I know for a fact I'm going to hurt you and it hurts me to hurt you. But I also can't stop this like cycle of self-destruction I'm in. Yeah, sorry, we were laughing a minute ago, and then I ruined it all.
In the same way that I was thanking you for your lyrics, I thank you for trusting me right now for going to this place. And my question is, and maybe it doesn't totally relate, but you know, I think that anyone with a creative impulse puts what they make out there with the hope on some level of getting some kind of response to it. With that in mind, what is the best thing that a fan could say to you? What would you hope that they would say? Not somebody who, you know, is looking to you to set an example or anything like that, but just somebody who really loves what you do. Like, what would you love for them to say that would make it feel worth it?
There's a really emotional answer and then like a silly answer. I'm going to give you the silly answer first. I was jogging the other day and I jogged by this guy, and without stopping, he just goes, "Love your music." And then just kept jogging. Whoa. And I was like, that's the awesome. Perfect, that's the perfect interaction. You know what I mean? Hey, your music helped me not kill myself. And then I'm just like, wow, I feel like that's not what my music did. That's probably something you did for yourself, but it's cool for you to tell me that. Just like, you know, that happens to me rarely, but stuff like that does happen.
Oh, sure,
and
yeah.
Sometimes I'm just like, ah, honestly, the majority of people that I meet at shows, and it's been a while since I've been like out at the merch table, like yeah. talking to people after shows, but the majority of people that I meet are really genuine. They're just like, hey, your music means a lot. You know, it's usually after a show. So it's like people that had a previous awareness of like who I was because they bought tickets to this gig. And I don't know, like every once in a while, somebody will just be like, hey, like your music means a lot to me. I grew up in church. I struggled with addiction or whatever. And I feel like just those are the kinds of things that put me more at ease with sharing the parts of myself, especially on this record, that I'm uncomfortable with. Because the reward for me, for being honest, for making as true a testament as I'm capable of making to my lived human experience, the reward for that is having somebody feel understood. I think, you know, I said this earlier, but like fundamentally, I think music is a communication tool. It sure, it's entertaining or whatever, and you know, it's couched in a consumerist realm because that's how we listen to music and buy it or subscribe to Spotify or whatever. But when you dial music back, especially when you think about like the function of music in civilizations like throughout history, it's a communication tool. It's something that's transmitting information. Like, I don't know, people used to sing songs because the sung voice goes farther than the spoken voice. And like, it hurts you to scream. So singing is like a means to an end of communicating with people beautifully and seeking mutual understanding. And if I can ever, ever establish mutual understanding between, or the feeling of understanding with a person between myself or my songs and them, or between them and another person who likes my music, then that is the most valuable thing I think I can ever accomplish with my music.
That's the most beautiful, articulate response I could have ever imagined to that question. Thank you for that. And you're right. I mean, the mystery of music is something that's just so fascinating to me, because I mean, you find primitive instruments in from periods of history when we were just struggling to eat, you know? I mean, this was something that was obviously a priority. It wasn't something that was just a luxury. This was something that we needed. And that's so interesting to me.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, and that's why I think I've been thinking about this a lot with this record, because I have a lot of, after, you know, it's like we were talking earlier about, you know, being a performer and being so obsessed with the perfectionist element of not only like hitting all the right notes and delivering an immaculate performance, but also like saying the right and true thing. It's like understanding that music is woven into the fabric of humanity helps me remove the fear of ridicule or dislike of my music. I've never in my life been like, yeah, probably everybody's gonna like my music. No. People don't, like, tons of people don't like my music. That's fine. If I weren't fine with that, I could not have been a professional musician for more than a day. But, like, I think sometimes I, just like everybody, I am sensitive to judgment and I want to offer the best that I can into this world. But what makes music, and This is why my friends make fun of me, because it's like I'll find a way to like pretty much everything, even if it's like bad. They don't like it. I'm like, I don't know. It's like I'm the opposite of the devil's advocate, always trying to be like, there's a good thing in here. But yeah, like music is valuable because it fulfills the need to create music, to communicate. Music is valuable because it is something that another person has issued into this world to contribute to the giant human discourse that is always taking place through art. It's not valuable because it's better or worse than, or because it's more or less a work of musical genius. You know, like, I don't know. That's why I value music in the first place. And so I've gotten a lot less precious with people, you know, my music and people's opinions of my music, because I don't know. I love it so much. It sounds really corny to just be like, I love music. Music is my life. It's like a Hot Topic t-shirt, but it's true. It's true. I love music so much.
It's not corny if it's true.
Yeah. It can, or rather, it can be corny and true. Both and, not either or, my friend. It can be corny and true. My music is corny as hell. I have some really corny lines, I'll admit. It's not always corny, but it can get a little schmaltzy. And it's like, okay, yeah, corny stuff is true. Trite things are cliches for a reason, you know what I mean? Like, I appreciate so much people who are willing to draw upon the material of folk tradition and are willing to say things that have already been said because it's worth saying them again. There's so many artists like that are just making songs that I guess you could call, they could either be derivative or they could be an homage to a style, or they could be, you know, when you play like a folk standard or a jazz standard, you're trying to be true to the style. Or when you write a blues song, the lyrical content often takes on like a very specific style, right? So like, yeah. It's fine. It's just like, it's just, I just said music wasn't like language, but it is really like a dialect or like an idiolect. Wow. I could talk about this for a real, be careful, because I wrote 8,000 words about this for just my advisor.
Can you send me the PDF? I mean,
dude,
I love this.
I don't want, bro, okay. I remember I was like, I sent him like a 7,500 word draft, and I was like, Dr. Cates, like, I don't know if I'm on the right track, like, I don't know. This was an independent study. He was literally like, write about whatever. And then I wrote 8,000 words of like meticulously researched but also somehow like really harebrained chaotic theories about music and language. And I just remember sending him this like long PDF and him getting an email back that said, don't make it too hard on yourself, sent from my iPhone. And I was just like, bro. Like,
knife in your heart. Oh.
No, it wasn't even knife in my heart. It was like so funny because this guy is just like opening up a frantic student's email on his iPhone and being like, please stop worrying about it. Please stop. Don't put yourself through this. Meanwhile, I'm like crouched over microfilm or whatever. I'm just kidding. It's 2021. I don't use microfilm, but it was a funnier image if I was like, anyway, I'll say
beautiful mind style.
Yeah, beautiful mind style. There's like,
like strings and stuff.
Yeah. I was about to say yarn up on the it get, yeah, I don't know. I'll if you, maybe I'll make the PDF like free somewhere, so if
you
anybody,
you totally should.
Dude, so but yeah. It's super incoherent. I can't even describe, it's dumb. It's like House of Leaves but my brain about music.
That's so cool though. Oh, come on.
All right, maybe I'll edit it down a little bit more. I'll get one of my grad student friends to polish it up a little bit.
Preparing to talk to you, I read probably a couple dozen interviews that you give it, and the care that you give to all your responses is just so apparent in all of your interviews. I just want to thank you for that. It's so appreciated. I mean, have you ever learned something about yourself reading any of these profiles back? Like, have seeing other people's impressions actually been helpful for you?
I would say yes. I wish I weren't, because this is about to make me sound so narcissistic. And you know what? Maybe it is. Maybe there is an element of the human mind that is just predisposed towards narcissism because we're the only consciousness in our head, right? So like, it's just us all day long.
That's all we know.
Thinking about the protagonist, being the protagonist of our own life. I read like every single one back to myself, because, and I it's a huge compliment for you to tell me that that it comes across as if I'm like very caring.
Yes,
and
very
attentive with my words, because that's what I mean. There's a limit to how much any human can understand another human being, right?
Limit to the empathy, yeah.
A limit to the empathy, but also just like, I can't take what's in my brain and put it in your brain and have you understand it.
Like a thumb drive, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's no, I can't Vulcan mind meld you to understand. Yeah, but so like, I do think it is a really worthy goal for me to try to make communication as clear as possible, especially like one of the reasons why I keep coming back to this dumb thesis, but like one of the reasons why I chose to do study of language is because music is so much of a refuge from language to me. When you think about the idea that whenever you're going into a discussion or a paper or like a seminar, you need to define the terms that you're using, but like we live in a world where because of this like accelerated, because of the way that changes in language are accelerated through like social media or through our constant availability and communication, there's virtually no way to be sure that you are defining the terms correctly or that somebody is interpreting what you mean and all the different like connotations and subtexts of your word choice.
The exact way word is harder to find.
Dude, yeah, it's like some Flaubert stuff like
yes.
La soma juiced. I don't think that's, somebody in French class is going to be like, that was horrible. But yeah, that's why it's important to me to find like the best way to say a thing, because understanding is like the most fundamental human need, like to be understood. And man, when you ask me like, have I ever learned anything about myself from reading interviews back or listening to podcasts back or something, yeah, I've learned I'm super neurotic. Like every time I read back,
you get something more positive than that.
No, I'm just I said that humorously, but what I've learned is that like I do this with so many things too. I like make it way more complicated than it has to be. Like sometimes I feel like me being hyper aware and concerned with expressing myself clearly in language actually makes it harder to have a conversation for me and also for the other person, because they have to sit through me giving like a 10-minute preamble to every question I answer. It's like gotta be exhausting.
Well, after that beautiful discussion of communication and language, I'm gonna end with a kind of poorly phrased question, which is, what is next for you? What do you have? You've got this amazing record out. Hopefully we'll be able to get on the road and hear you play it live soon. But what are you working on next? What are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to going back on the road. And I, you know, it's this kind of like grass is always greener thing with musicians, because it's so easy. It's like the national pastime of touring to complain about tour. Right? Like all you ever do. I'm still in a group chat. I have not played a show in like almost 2 years, and I'm still in a group chat with the people I was touring with 2 years ago being like, remember hummus? Like, I don't know. It's so, but I do miss it, and I miss, because music is so communication based to me, I miss the physical act of exchange that happens in a live show. Like tonight, I think actually is like when the album release stream happens. And I was so grateful to play with my friends and my sweet boys, Matt and Cal and Noah, but it felt a little sterile. And so I'm excited to be back in the land of touring, and I'm excited to see shows again. Like honestly, everybody in interviews and like talking to other musicians, the question is always like, oh, I can't wait to play a show. But honestly, dude, like right before quarantine happened, when I had taken a whole bunch of time off and I wasn't touring, I wasn't performing, I wasn't rehearsing for anything, doing any interviews, I would go to like 3 shows a week. I would just go see bands like by myself. And I used to never do that, but then I realized it's such a freaking power move to just stand there with just you. And I just went because I wanted to put some music in front of my face, and I wanted to be taken somewhere else, and I wanted to be on the receiving end and be, like, you know, to use a churchy term, like, fed by that. So I straight up just can't wait until there are shows again. I'm going to go see, like, every band. It's going to be great. And I'll, you know, I'll spend all my money on tickets and, yeah, but bring it on.
Julian, thank you so much. I guess there's only one thing I have left to say, and I want you to pretend I'm jogging right now. Love you, music.
Thank you. Yeah, no, thank you for a wonderful conversation. It was actually enjoyable.
That's the best thing I can hear.
I appreciate it. No, seriously. Oh.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Inside the Studio, a production of iHeartRadio. For more episodes of Inside the Studio or other fantastic shows, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.